So we're here. It's the end of the day on, what the fuck day is it?
Oh,
Wednesday?
It's only Wednesday.
It's
I
only
wish
Wednesday.
it were Friday.
With Sue Chan, Hannah Chang, and Sarah Law, and we'll be joined by Nancy Wang hopefully soon. Nancy, if you're listening, we have a chair for you and a bunch of tea and liquor
Nancy.
and water.
Suspicious liquor.
Suspicious
I know, what
Asian
is
liquor.
that?
You guys want to try it?
Yes,
well,
let's try it.
Who can read the Chinese on there?
Oh,
yeah.
God,
it is.
I... Wait, Dong,
so
if I may ask, what are you? How do you guys answer when people
where
say
are you
that?
From? No, where are you from?
No, but really, where are you from?
Yeah.
So my parents are from Hong Kong.
Okay.
So I'm Chinese. What are you?
I'm half Taiwanese, half Malaysian. This
okay.
is Sue, yeah.
Sue is half Taiwanese, half Malaysian.
Hannah is Taiwanese.
Okay. Sarah.
And Sarah is Chinese and like white American, but
nice.
I'm from Hong Kong. I grew up in Hong
nice.
Kong.
Oh, nice. Solid.
Yep.
I studied abroad in Hong Kong. Does that
Sue,
win me any points?
Did you get any Hong Kong connections?
Do I have Hong Kong connections? Like any Hong Kong blood in me?
Yeah.
Or
no.
any ties?
It's like
have you eaten dim sum there?
It's straight up.
Do you like Hong Kong?
Yeah. Chinese expat blood. My parents live in Shanghai
Wait,
now.
How does this
though.
Thing even pour?
Count
like that.
It's like Listerine.
Is that rubbing alcohol?
Are you sure?
I'm not very Chinese. Oh, there we go.
Whoa, whoa,
whoa.
I think that's
all right, I'll do a very small. I can take that one if it's too much. So I went across the street to try to get
just
wine.
Just really breathe it in.
Yeah, just it's probably
whoa.
More of a.
That is stronger than tequila meets
wow.
really bad vodka.
We can like clean the glass with this.
Chinese moonshine.
It's like rubbing alcohol.
I'm almost positive my parents had this
rubbing
when I was growing up.
Chinese
yeah.
rubbing alcohol.
Yeah.
Is this,
well,
is this
drinkable?
A sipping drink?
This will kill us. Cheers to our last drink.
Cheers.
Together.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah thanks
thank
for
you.
By.
I think it's disintegrating the cup.
Mm-hmm.
It might. Actually, whiskey does that to these cups, and this seems way stronger
wow.
than whiskey.
Whoa.
Oh, cool.
How do you describe that aftertaste? Dates?
Kind of like dates. There's like a weird like...
Yeah, Dong poured it.
Like... old fruity flavor to it.
Yeah. That makes me want to pucker up my lips.
You know, it's not that bad actually. Kind of into it.
Well,
it tastes like plum. It's plum. I think it's plum.
It's probably plum
liqueur.
Wine.
Yeah.
No, it's rice wine.
Or rice
it's
wine.
It's oh. back. Let's see. Oh, glutinous sorghum,
oh,
wheat,
there
and water.
Go.
Top quality.
Oh wait, let me get. Hold on. Give me one sec. I'm gonna get cups for the tea.
It's very elaborate. Do you have any other drinks?
Yeah, just for everyone out there, this is the most hospitable podcast
we've
experience ever.
Been to.
Would you like some tea?
There's
water?
Tea?
I think there
water.
Might be La Croix, but I don't know if it's out.
Peanuts on the table?
We have peanuts. They're Chinese peanuts on the table. This is from Chen and Kai when they came as a gift.
Oh,
I really
love
nice.
Them.
You're just supposed to stare at it.
Can we touch
and
it?
Maybe touch it. Doesn't really have a function. Except as a centerpiece. All right, so...
Except art.
You guys, this is by far the largest group of people we've had.
Don't be intimidated.
There's like
right
40
here.
Cups on the table.
I don't want any tea.
Okay, does anybody else want
tea?
I want tea
liquids.
Just for the...
The look?
Just for the look. Just to be more Asian. And so the really, I guess, dumb reason... Well, so Sue, you actually organized this whole...
Yes.
Panel of folks.
These are some of, I think, the most inspiring to me, women in New York City, and they all happen to be Asian. No, but really, growing up, when I first moved to the States when I was 5 years old, I tried really hard to assimilate to American culture and refused to have anything in my lunchbox that had like Mandarin character or you know Chinese characters, and really tried not to be Asian at all, and had all white friends, and didn't even have a single Asian friend until I was probably like post college.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
San Diego.
Aren't there Asian Dude. People there?
There are Asian people there.
Did we know this?
No. Okay. Sick. I thought maybe you were Taiwanese, but no, you grew up in San Diego.
San Diego.
I saw it on your bio. Yeah. That's what I wanted to talk to you about.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. So it wasn't until I, you know, graduated from college and then after that started just meeting people who had similar interests and who also happened to be Asian. But honestly, though, growing up, there weren't a lot of Asians with similar interests. Mm-hmm. And that was mainly actually why I didn't have a lot of Asian friends, to be honest. I mean, I grew up with a lot of Asian kids, but a lot of them were the stereotypes, which, yeah.
And how long have you known Hannah and Sarah?
How long have I known? That is a very good question.
Probably at least 4 or 5
years,
yeah, right?
Definitely.
It's the same.
Yeah.
Oh, four and a half years.
Yeah. Because I met you through, what, the Sweet Green guys?
But I think we met through Cat O'Dell first.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And then...
But that was here in New York.
Dana. Through Dana and the CFDA Peace program. Tree, yeah. Exactly.
But that all happened in New York?
All happened in New York, yeah.
Thank God for
New York. Feel like I've, like, only very recently found, like, my clan and my people. Like, it took me a long... Very awkward until 5 years ago. No, no, but I mean, I don't know. I think that a big reason why I moved to New York was to, like, find my people. Like, yeah. I did not really feel like I fit in Southern California with all the blonde, blue-eyed people.
The Aryans.
And I also grew up... I also grew up in, like, this weird neighborhood that... I mean, well, we can now talk about San Diego.
San Diego
I grew up in Carmel Valley, which is a suburb of San Diego County, right next to Del Mar.
Did you go to Torrey Pines High School?
I went to Torrey Pines High School. Fuck? Yeah.
Did
you too?
Yeah.
What?
Wait, we didn't
what
talk about
are
this?
You?
Me
no.
too. Me too.
I was like, I want in on this. Wait, what year are you?
97.
I was 02.
No wonder. Yeah.
So Good you God. Know. So you know about Rancho Santa Fe feeding into Torrey Pines.
Sure. Yeah.
And we grew up with a lot of rich kids, right? And also, I mean, it was a public school, but it was definitely a very privileged place to grow up. And I don't know, I just never really felt like I fit in.
So I grew up in Claremont.
Okay.
Which is like very kind of just like middle, like anonymous middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents found a nuts deal on a house in Rancho Santa Fe.
Oh, damn. So you're one of those kids.
I was one of those kids.
Rancho Santa Fe is like the most expensive zip code in America.
Oh, wow.
It's like McMansion beyond McMansion.
You
can't even see the McMansions. They have so much property. You know, they're like buried into like...
Yeah. But how do you find a crazy deal? If it's too
I have
good
no
to be
clue.
True.
I don't know how... I didn't ask.
It's too good
My parents
to be
probably
true.
Killed
yeah, it's
someone.
It's too good to be true.
But it was funny because...
They probably didn't want you to know how much money they had.
Yeah.
Well...
It was a good deal. Don't ask us for
Yeah, they hit it really well.
Make you work harder.
But I remember actually when they, because I had never heard of the neighborhood before, and then when they told us, and actually as soon as you get there, you can tell it's like one of those places like, oh shit, this is rich people.
You're like, we've made it.
Well, thanks, it was weird. It
There's
was
like two it. Country clubs in the neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Well, because
one
like,
wasn't good enough.
I remember
two.
For a while because as a kid you have no idea what lower middle or upper class means. You're just like, there's rich people, there's poor people, and
there's
everybody
us.
Else. And the house we moved out of was definitely not a Rancho Santa Fe kind of house. But I remember, because both my parents worked full-time, and they, in my mind, they were wealthy, even though they weren't. But because we had food on the table, they had two cars, like we had a VW, two VWs. And so when they moved to that neighborhood, I was like, jig is up. You guys have been rich this whole time.
Yeah.
And then they had to explain, actually, that like, and it was true that the price they got in the house was somehow half, if not a third of, I don't know, I have no idea how.
Creepy.
I never
Something
actually figured
definitely
out.
Went down in the
Someone's
house.
Probably
it was
down.
The Heaven's Gate house.
We were like,
do you guys remember
was
the
murder?
We were 5 blocks away from Heaven's
Gate.
Gate.
Do you guys remember that the Nikes, yes. the cult, yeah, that happened in Rancho Santa Fe.
The Cortezes.
Yes.
You definitely live in that house.
That's probably my house.
There's might, no,
yeah, I was the
you
one
got
that escaped.
For a third of the price?
It was crazy.
That's definitely.
It was.
There's probably like
these
a portal
aren't adding
to
up.
Yeah.
I think your parents told you it was 5 blocks away, but
it was like that like room
zero.
That was locked.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah.
But part of that was like not only was it super white, but not fitting in obviously with that level of wealth.
Well, what did you? How did you feel at Torrey Pines High School?
Well, I also moved. I moved. Thanks for interviewing me, guys. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah. Actually,
this is about you,
panel about you, Dom.
Poor women.
I'm sweating. It's really hot back here.
You sure you want that?
Yeah. I forgot the question. Oh, So I mean, I moved, or my parents moved right between middle school and high school. So it was not only like entering a new high school, but a new high school where everybody knew each other.
Right.
I hung out with the one kid that was also randomly from my middle school. We hang out for a week and realized we weren't really going to be friends. I mean, we're like, fuck you. But it was like, well, we have better friends we're making now.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Best of luck. See
yeah.
That was nice that you mutually agreed.
Well, literally, it was.
My fear is like the friend decides that they don't want to be friends with me. And it's like, oh, okay, same. I'll just go sit over there by myself.
So crushing.
No, but it was like, you definitely, I definitely didn't feel like I was ever part of that neighborhood or the school. It's gnarly.
There's like a toxic smell in
there. Yeah, there's a lid, I think, on the table.
That, yeah. Yeah. Put all matches away.
My stomach is burning right now from the little sip I have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just to move it away from me, I also never felt like I belonged anywhere until college. I had a really Berkeley, so filled myself with Asians basically.
Lots of Asians.
Yeah. I realized the group of friends I had in high school were all like the group.
Situational.
I got rid of them after.
I love that word.
No, they were like, we were like those.
But that is what happens when you're growing up. Totally. Your friends are situational.
You're forced to grow up with them.
No, I'm actually still incredibly good friends with the high school friends because they were all the slightly weirdo. Like, we were the band kids, like the rock band kids, not the nerdy.
Explains a lot.
But my favorite part was afterwards, because it was really cliquey at the high school. So we were known as either the heroin or the homosexual clique, which we were neither.
Yeah, but
two of them at the time now are, but at that point we weren't.
Yeah.
I was really proud that we were that group. Uh-huh. And I think it helped a lot that it was sort of all the kids that didn't really fit in. Anyway, that's my story. So you moved when you were 5 to San Diego?
To Lubbock, Texas. Oh. Good old state of
Texas.
You've
never mentioned that to me before.
Yeah. Well, my parents were in grad school at Texas Tech. And so they actually, funny story, when I was born, I wasn't born with a nationality because my father was from Malaysia. And there's something in...
Where were you born?
I was born in Taiwan.
Okay.
And my father was Malaysian. They met in college at Taiwan National University. I don't know why I'm pointing at you.
My dad went there.
I was like, you probably know. Yeah. You know all about this. But your citizenship is based on your father in Taiwan or in China.
And chauvinistic.
So, I know, so chauvinistic. And so because my dad, for whatever reason, couldn't prove that he was Chinese because he's from Malaysia, so I just, like, didn't have a nationality. So I couldn't go with my parents to grad school in the States. So my grandparents pretty much raised me from, like, 0 to 5. I mean, of course, my parents came and visited me. But then...
Once a year.
They just left me. But then I... Then eventually we figured it out, and I went to the States to meet up with them.
Wow, that's crazy.
To meet up with them.
A lot.
I know. It really does.
Do you know why they ended up moving from Lubbock to San Diego?
Well, first they went to LA. My parents did their postdoc work at UCLA, so that's why they moved to LA. Yeah.
Hannah, Sarah, were you guys born in the U.S.?
Born in the U.S. in Massachusetts. My dad was getting his master's and PhD at UMass Amherst.
Oh, wow.
And also went to National Taiwan University. I feel like a lot of the Taiwanese immigrants in the U.S. all went to National Taiwan University because you basically had the best chance of getting
for
out.
Sure. Getting
out of
it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Huh. And
what was he studying?
I want to say some kind of engineering. Electrical, mechanical engineering. So later in life, he wrote trading algo programs for banks and for hedge funds. And it's interesting because sometimes he thinks that if I stayed in Taiwan, life would have been a little easier because, you know, in the U.S., we're working so hard constantly. He worked insane hours. So I asked him, why'd you leave? And he said, I graduated from the best college, and the job I had paid me in physical TV units, if I was lucky. And then so you had to go pawn off those TVs to actually make money.
Well, like, here's your month's pay of 5 TVs?
That's a crazy
story. Or like half a TV?
Like, oh, here's 1 TV. Yeah, insane, right? So
was it a TV-related job?
I don't
know. Or they just had like a surplus
I think back then there weren't that many really good opportunities in Taipei. At least that's what it seemed like to me.
Yeah.
So then he moved here, and then I was born while he was in school. So I was born here.
Got it. Sarah?
I was born in L.A. And then I think maybe a few months after I was born, our family moved to Hong Kong. And my dad's family's all there. So
how long were you in Hong Kong?
I went to boarding school when I was 14 in Connecticut because my mom's from Rhode Island.
Okay.
So I think that was sort of a part of it was that she wanted us to have like an American education.
Right.
I was in Hong Kong until I was 14, and then my parents are still there now.
And where did you say your dad, what nationality did you say your dad was?
Well, he's originally, he's Chu Chow, and so it's like Southern Chinese, And his family was, I guess they had some factories, and they were also Baptist Christians.
Okay.
So during the Cultural Revolution, they were, like, really pushed out of China. And they went from, I know, from, like, Swatow to Shanghai, and then Shanghai to Hong Kong.
Cool.
So, I mean, at this point, he's been in Hong Kong for more years than he's been, you know, in China. But I would say he still, like, identifies as being Chu Chow.
Wait, is he still in Hong Kong?
Yeah, both my parents.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Both my parents are still in
Hong Kong. Do you go back there very often?
Yep. So for my work, I manufacture everything in China. Mm. So I probably go back maybe four times a year.
Five times a year, yeah. So just to get it out of the way, well, I mean, I guess actually it'll lead in other discussions, but can we just go through what you guys do?
Sure.
And we'll start with you, Sarah.
Okay. I have a handbag line called Kara, and I started it, or I launched it 5 years ago this past August. So I've been doing that in New York City, and I went to Parsons School of Design, studied fashion, and always sort of like wanted to have a company.
Did you work in fashion before you started your own line for a while?
Yeah, I worked at, so I was run up for Designer of the Year, and like kind of from all of that like thesis show and everything, I got introduced to Patrick Robinson, who at the time was the creative director of Gap, and he hired me to do women's like accessories. So I primarily did like print pattern for like scarves, and then I assisted on like shoes and bags and jewelry and stuff like that.
And then you said about 5 years ago you started Kara.
Yeah, I started a little bit more than that. I probably started it like 7 years ago.
Okay.
So I spent kind of the first half of my 20s just like saving up money to start the company because that was sort of like what I had in mind. I really wanted to have my own business. So I had some like side jobs, and I also at the time had another business. I had another business dyeing rugs. So I would, I don't know if you guys, like kind of like 10 years ago, there was like a really big trend.
I did not know this, unfortunately.
Wait, really?
Yeah, like you go by like ABC Carpet and Home, and there would be like these like $6,000 antique rugs that were like dyed pink or something.
Oh. Okay.
And one of my like majors, or one of my, sorry, like minors, like something I spent a lot of time in school was like fabric manipulation. So I would go up to Brimfield.
So technical.
Yeah. I would go up to Brimfield, the huge like antique show, and I would like fill up a truck with like 20 rugs, and I would dye them in my ex-boyfriend's like backyard and then resell them at like the Brooklyn Flea. So just tons of odd jobs. Like I did that. I was also like one of my part-time jobs while I was at Gap was a uniform designer. So I did some of the uniforms for the Standard, the Palm. They like all the Palm restaurants outside of like the two original ones in New York are franchised by like the Exterior family. So I did like the uniforms for that. I did the uniforms for like Carnival Cruises.
It was, like, wait, 22. Through Gap?
No. This was just like a side job. I was just doing every kind of side job you could think of just to make more money. Huh. And that was kind of like what.
Those
I was
are big clients.
So I was working for like an actual woman who had a uniform company.
An actual woman.
Yeah, like it wasn't just me as like a 22-year-old person like pitching. Yeah, totally. That was not happening.
I forgot how. Oh, Hannah, sorry. Let's go to what you do.
My sister and I own Mimi Chang's Dumplings. We have two locations, one in the East Village and one in Nolita, and we make dumplings, noodles, and everything delicious based on our mom's recipes. But previous to that, I worked in finance for 8 years, and my sister worked in fashion as well.
Oh.
Oh, cool.
We have a sister pair that we're working with on a different project, and it's exactly the same, like one finance, one fashion.
Oh, really? What are they doing now?
They're basically building out like a fitness social food club thing. It's like they're taking over a 7-story building and basically making a new like social club in the city, but it's like fitness focused. And
holy shit.
What is it called?
High Court.
Where?
It hasn't started. It's not physically in the world yet.
Give me an address.
Yeah, it's on.
Scope it out.
But it'll be on Broadway below Canal. So it's like on the border of Tribeca in Chinatown, basically.
Nice. Cool.
But that combo, I was like, oh, that's a fruitful combo of background. When did you start Mimi Chang's?
4 years ago.
Okay.
First one, and the second one opened up 2 years ago.
The first one was West Village, right?
East Village.
East Village. Where is it in East Village?
Second, between 11th and 12th, next to the movie theater.
Oh, yeah, okay. Mm. Got it. Mm-hmm. I walk by the Nolita one every day, but somehow, for some reason, I kept picturing there was one in the West Village, but I think I'm just like remembering the wrong spot.
Could be.
Maybe it's like,
you
looking
know,
in the future.
That's where the third one will be.
Yeah, right?
And did you guys both leave fashion and finance at the same time. So like, fuck it, we're going to start something else.
No, our parents were freaking out that we wanted to quit our dream jobs and open a quote unquote Chinese takeout restaurant. So they said we were planning on quitting at the same time, but they said my sister could quit fashion first because if everything went under or it didn't work out, I could support the both of us. But if it was the other way around,
look how she couldn't figure it out. You would have to support both of you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, fashion is basically you get paid minimum wage for the amount of hours that you work.
What was going to be the consequence from your parents if you guys didn't follow that?
There was no consequence. They just applied a lot of strong pressure and coercion. Yeah. So she quit first and then did a lot of the legwork of looking for spaces, learning, researching, finding vendors. And then she worked at Sweetgreen for the 7 months they first opened.
Oh, amazing.
Because we're friends with the guys who started it, and they said they thought that Mimi Trains was a great idea, but noted that neither of us had any restaurant experience. Not to be dissuaded, but they're like, maybe you should try come with us.
But like a few months in.
Totally. And it was a great experience.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, so that's how it worked out.
So they were supportive, though, of knowing that she was going to leave at some point and start her own thing.
They eventually became supportive. Hmm. So they went from being like, this is the worst idea ever. You guys both went to amazing colleges. You have your dream job, and then you're going to quit it and open a Chinese takeout restaurant, which is every immigrant parent's worst nightmare. Because you're like, you don't need to go to an expensive private college to do that.
This is exactly what we worked so hard for you not to do.
Exactly, exactly. So, but then when they saw that we were really serious about it, they were behind us 300%.
That's amazing. Awesome.
It's amazing, yeah. And I always ask them, like, how did you go from being so unconvinced that this was a good idea to you are here working day and night during our opening, and our dad, we started calling our dad the intern because he would run and fetch stuff on my sister's city bike. And I have a picture of him where he's in the restaurant before we open and he's napping with his head against the wall because he's so tired.
Slave driving.
Yeah.
Unpaid internship.
Unpaid, yeah. So it's funny because they originally came for 2 weeks to help us open the first location and ended up staying 2 months.
Amazing.
So now every time they come, they always have a departure date because I think that they're scared of getting stuck here.
Oh, please don't put us to work.
Yeah. They're like, we're coming for 5 days and we're leaving. This is what time we're
You should be like, surprise, we're opening our third location when you're here.
Your yeah.
Exactly. So,
do they stop by the restaurant or one of the two locations every time?
Like, they go to both locations all the time, but they live in Taipei for half the year, and then they live in Arizona for the other half. Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Sue?
What do I do?
What do you do?
No, I'm kidding. I run a brand management agency. We represent chefs, restaurants like Mimi Chang's, and food brands, and then we're now starting to explore wellness, travel, and home products.
Called so Care of Chan.
It's called Care of Chan, exactly. And I mean, the reason why I like hesitate whenever someone's like, what do you do? It's because I feel like the landscape that I work in is very much changing. Not the food industry. I mean, the food industry is changing, but also just PR, mm-hmm. events, marketing, that is changing so mm-hmm. much. So I think the best thing to call ourselves is just like a brand management agency. But we specialize in communications, event production, and talent management.
With the focus on, you said, the food industry?
Yes, right now, the food industry. I think we want to do, like, food and living is what we want to do, yeah.
Did you have when did you start Care of Chan?
2 years ago.
Did you have a background in the food industry before that?
Yes. So prior to that, I was at Momofuku as the brand director for 7 years. So essentially what I was doing there is what I do now for other chefs, restaurants, and food brands. Yeah.
And that was across, like, all the Momofuku?
Yes. My team oversaw PR, marketing, events for all the restaurants in New York, Sydney, Toronto, for Lucky Peach, and then also for Dave Chang. Mm. Yeah.
So this is kind of an open question. I don't know how to tackle this, sort of having three different guests at a time, so I'll have to see how this works.
Okay.
Did any of you have...
You should get like a buzzer.
Yeah. First answer wins. Were any of your parents, are any of your parents entrepreneurial? Did you have models of people like in your family running their own business?
Actually, the other day my mom was like, it's so strange that you're an entrepreneur. Like, I don't know where you got that from. Because it definitely takes a special You're all special, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, let's all pat ourselves on the back right now.
It's an amazing, incredible person. Yeah.
You have to be bold, strong, unique. No, but it does. I mean, you must be insane to, or I don't even know. It's hard being an entrepreneur.
I think it's true.
Struggle with it every day. Yeah.
My dad was really entrepreneurial. I mean, he dropped out of school when he was 14. So I think at this point he's had like every job I can think of. He was a, I don't know, I probably hate that I'm going to say this, but probably also won't listen to this. So, but
hey, Dad.
He dropped out of school when he was 14, and then one of the first things he was doing was counterfeiting money.
Oh, nice. What?
Yeah,
I love that.
Did
he get caught?
No. And the only difference for a short time, I think
it's covered.
It became, I mean, it happened so many decades ago now. But, and then he was doing fiberglass parts for motorcycles because he was really into cars.
That sounds like a badass.
Yeah, he's got a very intense story. And at some point or another in his like late teens, he became an encyclopedia salesman. And he found out that if you sell encyclopedia to the boss of the company and you get them to refer people, when you show up at the employee's door and you say that your boss recommended you buy these, people always end up buying. So he would look for all the bosses of all these companies and like kind of from there get more and more commissions because he would be like selling to all their employees.
And so this was literally like door-to-door.
Door-to-door, yeah. He had a motorcycle and would just like go like barman to barman. And he basically went to someone's house who was like more on the like British side of Hong Kong, and this guy was like, you know, you seem like a really good salesman, you seem really smart. You could make a lot more money if you sold mutual funds. So he asked him to come in to his office, and basically from there he started selling mutual funds. And I mean, he's had so many jobs because I think the main place where he really ultimately ended up making money is kind of more in real estate and in commodities trading.
Okay.
But along the way, when I was a kid, he had like a numero uno pizza chain in Hong Kong. He had like 9 of them. He sold watches, and we had like a really big license with Disney for a long time. So like as a kid, I'd go to Disneyland for free.
Nice.
Every time we came to LA in the
summer.
Jesus,
you had that dream childhood.
But and he had a picture frame business that went to one of his cousins.
Wait, so at what point did he like go to the next thing?
So he went to mutual funds, and then I know he's always done like all these side hustle things and like tried his hand at a lot of stuff. But I feel like he ultimately like ended up doing like some kind of financial advisory type of work in maybe his 30s. In the Middle East.
I love how he like he ended up.
Yeah. Did he fill out an application where they had a question? Have you ever done any counterfeit trading?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but that's how I met my mom, actually. My mom was working in Saudi Arabia as a dental hygienist for the royal family's hospital.
Jeez.
And he was like doing some financial advisory for like the king's, I think two of the sons or something like that. And everyone that worked for the royal family like lived on the same compound. So that's how they met. And then basically, since I've been alive and from what I remember, he's always pretty much worked in the Middle East. And then he had that like crazy pizza chain for a while.
Just on the side.
On the side that he like, I think just, he has like PTSD when he goes to restaurants because he just like, I think it was like a really bad experience.
Why was it so crazy?
The restaurant?
Yeah.
He's just like not a... Probably just like, you know.
But yet he had 9 of them, though.
Yeah, I know. I mean, my dad
I feel like after
out,
one, after and if it was crazy,
one,
I'd be like,
I think
I'm
he
not
just opened
anymore.
All
like
of them at once,
more.
And he did it for like several funny. Years.
That seems like that would make you crazy.
So in Hong Kong in like the early 90s, it was like really trendy to bring American like franchises. And I remember he really tried to get.
Pizza Hut?
No, not Pizza Hut, the burger.
Burger King?
No. It's in L.A. Why am I forgetting?
In-N-Out.
He, like, was, like, gung-ho about getting bringing In-N-Out to Hong Kong, and, like, the family would have none of it. So his next resort was Numero Uno Pizza from Chicago. It was, like, deep dish pizza.
So he went from not owning any restaurants or having worked in a restaurant to owning 9?
Yeah. I think this is actually probably like a really good way to like sum up my dad. I mean, he would tell me these crazy stories. Like, there's a lot of like gangs in Hong Kong, like triads and stuff like that, and you would have to pay protection money. So he refused to pay it, and then people would come into the restaurant right when they opened, and like there'd be like 20 guys for 20 tables, and they'd order like a Diet Coke for the entire day
until you paid.
Just sit there, like, waste all of your money. Like, nobody gets up the entire time. You make no business. And then, obviously, people get really creeped out because it's just, like, an empty restaurant with, like, one guy at a table. So he has so many crazy stories. And he just, I think, that's, I mean, at the end of the day, like, I think I grew up definitely seeing him doing a lot of stuff. He opened up offices, like, all over the Middle East and a lot of Asia and stuff like that.
Did all his ventures succeed?
No, a lot of them did not. A lot of them did not. I mean, at the end of the day, I think where he's really been successful has been finance and real estate, which I think are, like, a lot of people would be like, yeah, that makes sense. Those are like the jobs that, like, why Asian parents want their kids to have those jobs.
Does he still work right now?
He's semi-retired. He still does some real estate work. And then I know he goes into his office in Hong Kong when he's there, like, every day and kind of checks in on stuff. But I think at this point, too, like, commodities trading is really different because so much of it is done online, whereas, you know, in the, like, 70s all the way until, like, maybe even, like, early 2000s, you could still do more of it in person, like, relationships, stuff like that.
So, like, seeing all that growing up, did you have – I was – like, when you started Kara
– yeah.
Does it feel like something you're going to do before you move on to something else? Or does it actually feel like this is my life that I'm dedicating myself to now?
I mean, my hope is that this is my life. I think where I'm different from my dad is, like, I think I'm really entrepreneurial and I'm really work-oriented the way that he is. But I'm like, and he always is getting on my case about being, like, much slower than him. And, like, you know, like, I walk slowly. I'm not, like, in a rush to do stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm, like, really focused. Whereas my dad's kind of, like, got, like, multiple pots on the stove kind of thing. Always. But, yeah, I think for me, I've just always been a lot more interested in having one thing and doing it really well. Hmm. Whether or not I am doing well or not, I have no idea. But, yeah, I would love, it would be amazing for me to say that, like, you know, this is what I always do forever.
Was there still a fear when you started Kara that kind of like, oh, shit, this is a leap? Or were you like, actually, I've seen my dad do this?
Yeah, there was a lot of fear. I mean, it just I went to Parsons and I thought it was a good education for, like, the technical side, but there was so much information that was missing in terms of, like, literal things like sales seasons and how you do marketing and PR and how you, like, how do you find a factory if you don't come from, like, manufacturing? So there were so many details, and I just made so many mistakes, I would say, I probably would say I'm still making a lot of mistakes, but the first, like, 2 years was just, like, a lot of trial and error and a lot of, like, finding people who could, like, help me out. And I mean, like, I remember, like, one of the big, I think you, in particular when you have a business, like, one of the big things you can call a mistake is, like, losing money. That's, like, the biggest, easiest way to quantify what a mistake is. And I just remember so many mistakes at the beginning of just maybe not reading contracts properly. That was, like, one of the first lessons that I learned very quickly is, like, how do you read it?
Definitely don't do that again.
Yeah. I mean, those are, like, it's funny because I think we've, in some places, made, you know, bigger errors later on, but you kind of get, like, sort of more like that initial trauma of making mistakes the longer you have your company is like, okay, this is just what happens. But I feel like that first year, like every time you make a mistake, you're like,
everything
holy
is like end of the world.
Shit, this is so
crying
bad.
In the bathroom. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. My parents are definitely traumatized from the calls. So I'm like, Mom!
Yeah.
Dad.
Yeah. I think also when you first open your business, everything's so much more precious, too. It's like your ego is so much more wrapped into it. And sometimes when we work with new brands, I'll like see that. And, you know, I like definitely feel
And
for
the
them.
Things that you like think everyone else is seeing that nobody gives a shit about.
Because guess what? The world is doesn't revolve around you.
Yeah, totally.
So. Hannah, do you also come from a family of entrepreneurs?
I would say my dad's not very entrepreneurial, but he's really good at investing his money. And my mom has always been a jack of all trades. So she's really smart. Like, she speaks 9 languages.
Amazing.
She can pick up anything. And her curiosity for life is insatiable. So she's done real estate. She's done travel agency. She's done Mary Kay. She's done multiple things. So from that, and actually our LLC, her Joyful, her travel agency was named Joyful Travel. So we thought it'd be funny for our first LLC to call it Joyful Eats as a, homage to her. And they're both pretty conservative in a sense. So they've never felt like we had to rush into anything. And I think it was a Malcolm Gladwell book that talks about it takes 10,000 hours to be an expert in anything. And I really appreciate the fact that what Sarah was just saying about going slowly and taking your time and focusing. Because, you could have multiple pots on the stove at the same time. But if 10,000 hours is what you need and you're dividing your time among 5 things, it's just going to take you that much longer to become an expert or proficient in that one thing. So I'm actually not a big believer in multitasking anymore, even though when I was working on trading floor, that's all you talk about. But then you realize how scattered your attention and your energy are everywhere. Like phone call, chat. Oh, no, we're back to the phone call now. No, and just constantly all over the place. Whereas if you just stopped and focused, you'd be much more efficient.
Did you feel like starting Mimi Chang's was a way to focus? Was a way to like, all right, we're going to actually like commit to one thing as opposed to like running around on a bunch of stuff?
Well, no, because we weren't really running around on a bunch of stuff at that point. For us, it was, honestly, we just opened a restaurant because we were hungry. We missed our mom's cooking and thought, okay, maybe there's other people like us that miss that kind of cooking that doesn't have MSG, that isn't super oily, that uses organic ingredients. And it's funny because we recently got a negative Yelp review and the review said, tastes just like home. Like, great, thank you. That's what we were trying to say.
So funny.
Nothing special, tastes like home. Like, great.
You're like, perfect.
That's what we were going for.
Yeah.
That should be your like window poster.
Thank you so much for that compliment.
I hope you replied to her.
I'm going to, actually. I just haven't yet. I found it so funny. Like, that's not an insult. Maybe at your home, your
like, we would have paid for that review. That's
right,
amazing.
Exactly.
But you had mentioned something where, besides putting in long hours, your parents had a switch where they're like, okay, we're fully behind. Do you know why? And you asked them why, but I don't know, maybe I missed it. But why was that switch?
When we were just talking about it, they were against it. But then when we signed a 10-year lease in New York City, they're like
they're
all
committed.
Right. Yeah, committed.
You got our year.
Exactly. So then they threw their entire weight behind
us.
Because
if not to generalize, but Sarah and Sue, what you guys do now is in an expansion of kind of in a way what you were doing before. I mean, like it's your own version of it, but you had a trajectory that led you to starting your own companies.
Yeah.
And yours is obviously a really discreet break, but for you and your sister.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question is like, well, at which point did you know that, like at which point for you did you know that, okay, shit, I need to start a restaurant? Was it years while you were still in finance? Or is there just a moment, and then 6 months later, you were somehow opening a restaurant?
I would say it was years, but more like we thought we were like, oh, it would be cool to do this. Oh, we really miss this kind of food. Oh, we haven't really found anything like this, and we just kept talking about it for probably a year or two until it got to a point where my sister said, we have to do something about it or just stop talking about it, right? Because we've always been raised to be people of action and not word. So I always tell everybody, I don't care what you say, show me what you mean. So at that point, and she had been working in fashion and her team, corporate stuff had basically, her team basically disintegrated and she was the only person left with two juniors from a 6-person team. She was like, I'm ready to quit now. So now would be a natural break for her to try something different. And then after 2 years and my parents saw that it was sustainable and just, we had our really close aunt of ours passed away and that made me rethink of, okay, I calculated the amount of time I was spending on the trading floor and thought to myself, kind of cliche, but on my deathbed, when I look back on my life, if I've spent 74% of my waking hours at work, how do I feel about that? And the idea of living a life that had no significance scared me to death. So I was like, all right.
Actually, apparently one of the things that people say is their biggest regret when they're on their deathbed is working too much.
I think it's okay to work a lot if there's significance.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, it was a great job. I learned a lot, and I love the people I worked with. But there's nothing...
It didn't bring you any pleasure.
Right. Yeah. It didn't satisfy my soul on a deeper level. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, owning a restaurant, it's creative. I can create joy for people and not just money. And
joyful eats.
Joyful eats. Yes. And also I see it kind of as a social justice platform because the people we hire, the amount of money we pay, the way we treat people, the environment we create, and it's really cool to create a little difference, even if it's just for a handful of people.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys know or sort of like assume that you'd start something on your own at some point? Like was it like... At some point, I'm going to have to start something, or I plan on starting something. I'm only working here to learn enough to start something. No.
That was always on my mind.
Really?
Starting something. Yeah, just always. I think that's what
like
I was...
through school, like.
Yeah, I mean, when I kind of like think back to like, I definitely remember being in high school and like fundraising for our prom, you know, and like I don't remember being necessarily asked to do it, but I remember I went back to Hong Kong and I bought like maybe like 100 scarves for like $1 US and I sold them for $10.
Who would you sell them to?
Just people in my high school. I just remember doing a lot of projects like that. And in college, I would go home on the holidays and sew these like big portfolio bags that I could sell for like $25, $30 because we had huge sort of like big sketchbooks. So I feel like I was constantly, and it's sort of like weird because I remember thinking, like I kind of forgot about all these things that I did. And then maybe a few years ago, I started thinking about it. I was like, it's so funny, like looking back, I always was interested in like trying to, I guess, like make money somehow, but like from something more related to like being creative or making something, just always like an interest.
Did any of you guys take business classes or business degrees or anything?
Nope.
Oh man.
Sociology major.
No. I mean, there's like, I think when you talk about that like Asian stereotype of like math and all that stuff, like numbers, like I think logical, like rational things I'm like really good at. I also have a really good memory, but like math and like tons of data, like reading through, like for example, like when you sell to like department stores, the first thing they give you is this huge book on like when you have to ship to them, and these manuals are like 100 pages or 200 pages, and I literally like pass out when I see that. So I think that's like, I think one thing that I don't relate to at all.
But Hannah, you did.
So in high school, I took a business administration class, which was really helpful. I learned a lot of real life.
Do you think if you hadn't taken that class, would you be where you are now?
I don't think that one class changed the trajectory, but I did find it very helpful. And then I majored in finance at Georgetown. But again, kind of, I was thinking about this when you were talking about not learning like it was good at technical stuff, but not real world application of like, where do I find this or who can help me do this?
Yeah.
And actually, I feel like that might be the case for most schools, except for medical school, hopefully.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I found that was the case for working on a trading floor. You learn the time value of money, and then everything else you learn on the job. Mm.
That's one thing I thought about. I mean, I don't think I would be good at going. I think I did well in school for like when I was younger, but I just couldn't imagine going back because I think also like the money that it would cost to go to business school.
All my friends who go to business school, it's really just a social.
It's totally social.
It's for the network, meeting people, going on ski trips. Swear to God, a friend of mine who went to Columbia Business School, all she talked about was all the ski trips she went on.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Which is valuable. I mean, connections are valuable, especially in this digital age that we live in. Like the last thing you can't download, or the two last things you can't download, three last things, a handbag, food, and a connection, like a real genuine connection with someone, right?
Yeah. But the thing I have to say is like you potentially make some of that more easily. You get a little bit more like business related access in business school, maybe, but also maybe not. But then I think that I've just seen so many people who like didn't go to college.
You have it or you don't, I think.
Yeah.
But it's also like as soon as you start something, you're throwing yourself into, I can imagine even if you go to business school, you're not answering all of your black hole questions that you have when you start a project. And you're like, how the fuck am I supposed to run this business?
Yeah. I mean, you think about like for being a parent, like you don't go to like parenting school before you go to like be a
parent.
Maybe
some parents should though.
Probably some business owners should. I have no idea.
Yeah. But I think business school probably gives you confidence too, right? It's like if you want to start a business or have a desire to start a business.
I can certainly imagine it helps you plan.
Yeah.
I would say it probably helps in terms of planning.
Yeah.
But then the rest of it is kind of out of your control.
Mm-hmm. I will say though, I've been reading. I do read a lot of business books.
Yeah. I do a lot of that now.
You know,
too.
Harvard Business Review.
That have businesses. And try to find out like where they get information.
And it helps. It does help. Like if I'm working through something with like staff or whatever, like Harvard Business Review has been really helpful. And like you know, just advising me on like, oh, it's like things that are obvious once you read about it, but then structuring it or communicating in a way you're like, oh, now I can like put this into practice.
And I also feel like it's very helpful to even if, because I think without that kind of background, you're like, there's three options that actually seem objectively like decent options, but having no idea which one to choose and actually weirdly just seeing it in a book, you're like, oh, that makes, I guess I'll do that one because it's written down in a book.
And these really smart people have theorized about it, practiced it, and tested it, and now it's probably true,
But I think it's kind of nice in a way not to have a preconceived notion of, okay, this is how you do stuff. You know, somebody was asking me recently, so you've never worked in a restaurant, you never went to culinary school, you didn't go to hospitality school. What's, do you think that hurt or helped you? And I think as a whole, I would say it helped us because we didn't think, okay, this is how it has to be done, because it's always done like this at every restaurant across the board. And in that way, you can be more innovative.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's virtually every single, because we focus mostly on, for the radio show, people that are in some sort of creative field. Mm-hmm. And almost everybody, I think, whenever they started their own thing, even if they were coming from that industry, didn't really know what they were getting themselves into. It wasn't like, we know exactly the first step, second step, third step. And I think that's key with, you're intuitively going to try something new, whether you are planning to or not. But also probably you're going into it because there, you haven't seen something that you want to do yet. But I do think your point is, I think it's actually very, I don't know if it's like something you should plan for not having the experience going in, but it, I don't think there's a coincidence there that when people end up doing something new, it's because they hadn't really done that before or planned on doing that before. Right.
Even the way we laid out the restaurant for our first one, for when we only had one restaurant, we kept thinking, oh, if we just had some experience in a kitchen or went to culinary school, this would be so much easier. Yeah. Because you just apply common sense. You're like, yeah, this, sure, the sink should be here or whatever. And then we opened a second restaurant and had a restaurant designer lay everything out and stuff. And then after we operated that one for a while, we thought, actually, we kind of like the first one better. Yeah.
But the other thing I think is interesting is how industries change, because so much of fashion and like what I do is heavily marketing oriented. And from when I started the company or started working on the concept of the brand like 7 years ago until now, like Instagram is like formalized itself as such a thing. And, you know, the way you, like, I remember when I first got a website, you could either pay for a website and then pay double for a mobile website.
No way, really?
Yeah, it was like not related. And I didn't have enough money for both, so I just did a desktop site. And now, like, the idea of having someone tell that's you, amazing. Like, oh, your website's only going to work on a desktop is insane. And that's only like a few years ago.
Now it's like a feature that they like include.
Right. No, it's totally true. So I think that you could go to school for it, you could have a bunch of jobs, you could have a lot of experience, but a lot of times when you're doing your own thing, like whatever you're doing, potentially previous experience is not like an exact mirror.
Right. So you spent a chunk of time in Momofuku. Was there?
Did. By the way, update from Nancy Wang. She is not going to make it. She got stuck in K-Town. She was on her way 30 minutes ago.
Yeah.
I think she probably walked karaoke spot.
She's like, whoop.
I know. It's like, I'm going to do this instead.
No, I mean, it's not a bad place to get stuck.
Yeah.
Sympathize with that.
Yeah, I would do it too. No kidding. What were you asking?
Sorry, so you were at Momofuku for a while.
Yes.
And was there, I mean, it's basically like why start your own thing, but was there a moment while you were going through your work at Momofuku where you realized you needed to start Care of Tanner or your own project or business?
Yeah, I mean, so when I started at Momofuku, there were only four people. I was the fourth person in the office, in the headquarters, and by the time I left, there were probably like 30. Yeah. So there was intense growth in that 7 years. And also within the 7 years, the restaurant group had expanded internationally, opened a bakery, started a magazine. Like, it was a lot.
Was it just the noodle shop that was there when you first started?
Co had just opened. So Co was Dave's third restaurant.
Right.
Yeah. And Milk Bar was about to open. So I started probably like a month before Milk Bar opened and tasted a lot of like the first renditions of all like her Christina Tosi's treats. So why did I decide to leave? I mean, I like grew up there, and at a certain point, it was just time to explore other things. I mean, it was a really incredible experience, and I could have stayed forever and like had a really amazing career, but just wanted to see what else was in the world. And also, I think I'm very much a person who likes an adventure and likes change, and there was constant change there, and so that's why I think I stayed as long as I did. And it was obviously a really amazing place to work for, and I really respect Dave, and he's such a visionary. And I think it was also hard for me when I was thinking about what I was going to do next to just go to another restaurant group, because I very much felt like that was the top of the restaurant world, right, and the top of the food chain, so it would be difficult to just go into another restaurant group. But, and also, I think, you know, there were a lot of incredible people out there, like really amazing visions who I wanted to support. And similar to Sarah's dad, I think I like, you know, enjoy having lots of pots on the stove and have a lot of interests and wanted to help all those people and not just necessarily one person. I also really much, you know, very much enjoy creating a community and so wanted to grow like a new community within food.
Mm-hmm. Was there a client, let's say, was there a client that you kind of kicked it off with? You're like, I have a company now, what kind of
yes.
moment?
It was actually my favorite restaurant at that time, Estella. Mm-hmm. They were my first client.
Where, are they
what
the
number
ones?
Are we?
Ooh. You were probably...
You're talking about favorite or like...
Well...
Number client.
I think you were probably like top, like first five.
I just want to sure. say that second place is first loser.
Second place is first. Ouch. So Asian of you, Sarah, to say that. I think all losers are winners.
All losers? All yeah. losers are Jeez. Losers.
All losers are losers.
It's cutthroat.
Pete Meehan.
Nobody wants a participation trophy.
Yeah.
Pete Meehan, who's a former editor and founder of Lucky Peach, named our James Beard Foundation party Winners or Losers. So there's also that yeah, version.
Is Estella the one on Houston?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've been there once, and it was a sort of like sort of a celebration just with a friend and I. And halfway through, actually before the food came, she's like, oh, I just ordered a bunch of things and here is something I brought. And it turned out it was like a small shrooms brownie. And we're like, fuck it.
Whoa,
and
shit.
That was a terrible place to take shrooms, I realized very quickly. It wasn't like horrific.
Wait, why? Because it's like dark and...
No, just because it's really nice.
Oh, right.
And it's sort of it's not formal per se, yeah. but like we were sitting at the bar and you can't just be a dick yeah. anyway at that place. But all I wanted to do...
You shouldn't be a dick anyways in general.
Yeah. Especially this stuff. Yeah. But like all I wanted to yeah. do was... Well, I realized two major problems with that was... I remember as we were talking about it, we're like, we've never actually done shrooms in a restaurant. What happens? And it was like, apparently you lose your appetite. And I was like, damn. Whoa. That's such a sad...
That doesn't happen crazy. To me when I...
or like, and I realized because I never turn away food, but I realized all this amazing food was showing up and I had zero interest in it. I'd be like, that's interesting looking. And then we wouldn't even touch it. And then at some point, all I wanted to do was lie on the floor. Mm-hmm. So I basically left. I left her at the bar by herself as like the first set of entrees were coming out, and I feel I can't really like show my face in there. So that's my experience with that amazing restaurant.
Yeah,
I don't remember any of the food,
just the shrooms.
The floor looked really comfy,
and I can't go back.
I can't go back.
That's some real off-menu stuff.
Yeah,
I've never been served that.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did the Estella project or client or job, was that, because I think part of it is also I can imagine when you start a business, it's hard to know if it's going to survive at first.
Oh, for sure. I mean, actually, I feel like most entrepreneurs are serial entrepreneurs and
yeah.
end up having multiple businesses. And Sarah and I's mutual friend, Dana, she comes from a family of entrepreneurs, and both her brother and father have had a few businesses, and you know, the last one, obviously, or the current one, is like the most successful, which I think is really fascinating. To think that, like, at what point do you give up? Mm-hmm. Do you just keep going? I mean, also, when you start a business when you're really young, you might change your mind about what you enjoy
life,
right, and what your interests are. And I mean, I think that. What was the question?
Well, I guess it's like, so you're 2 years
Oh, at what point? Yeah, I'm 2 years
You're
in.
4 years
Well,
in?
I will say it takes 5 years to build anything. So any young budding entrepreneurs out there.
Crap, I have a timeline now.
I know. Well, but it takes 5 years to build anything when you kind of get in a groove, right? Mm-hmm. And that definitely happened at Momofuku as well. Like the restaurant group was growing rapidly, but I knew that I was responsible for a certain thing for that restaurant group, and it took me probably 5 solid years to really figure it out and to build that team into what it is now. And obviously it's like taken a whole new life, but yeah, I do genuinely think that it takes 5 years to build anything, because it's like the first couple years you're kind of learning as you go, maybe learning like what the business is going to be. Like we've definitely changed too in the short 2 years. Like at first we were just a communications firm, but then realized that, like, we can offer more than just PR, and also the PR landscape was changing with, like, technology and Instagram and events being important, and, you know, what we offer to clients isn't just media relations, it's much more than that. And so, yeah, so in the first couple of years, you make mistakes, you pivot, you figure out what you're good at, what you enjoy, and then it really takes, I think, up to 5 years to really hone that all in and be operating like a serious machine. And then from there, who knows what, you know, you can do. But
do you guys, you're on 5 years, is that right?
Yeah, August.
Do you feel like you've hit that groove yet?
Yeah, I mean,
serious machine groove.
It's interesting because, like, the truth is that I started the company without any business plan. I just, like, knew I wanted to make bags, and, like, the concept behind the brand was this idea of, like, handbags kind of for girls that don't wear a handbag. Like, I was really interested in identifying with people that didn't just have, like, maybe one clear identity, but, like, had, like, multiple identities or, like, multiple interests or... I think functionality was a big aspect. There was a lot of things about like starting the company that I felt like missing in the market and really spoke to where what I'm interested in. You know, I think coming from like Hong Kong and being half Chinese and half white too, like there were so many aspects of this like multicultural background that I felt like there wasn't really a brand that represented people with that sort of like commonality. But it's just funny because, you know, I started the first season, we got into 6 stores. We got Harvey Nichols, Opening Ceremony, Creatures of Comfort, Shop Bop, Essence.
Wow. That was first year.
Yeah, Lane Crawford. It was the first season. Mm. And also I started with a backpack too, which I felt like was something that wasn't really on the market at the time. And I love the idea that you could be like in New York and go out to work and then like go to the gym or go on a date or like whatever. And whatever you're wearing, it's great. So like the idea of a backpack that was all leather, like really minimal, seemed like it really spoke to what I was interested in doing. But also could have just as well been like this great idea that nobody liked. Mm. So when I first started, that really took off right away. And as we've gone through the past 5 years, I would say that's still a really strong seller for us, like iterations of this backpack and then a few other styles have been really strong sellers. But at the same time, you know, as a designer, like what my interests are and like how I want to grow as a person, I think I've changed a lot. Sort of like what you're saying, if you start a brand really young, which for me was 25, just I think I've gone through so many more life experiences since then that it was really important for me to make sure that people started to understand like what the brand was about, but also that it's about more than just like one singular style. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, like a lot of things have really like, you know, our production, our manufacturing, our sourcing, a lot of our marketing, like the way we run our website, a lot of logistical things are run really well. But then there's a whole other side of like the art direction and like what's the future of the brand that I feel like is really, it's open, you know.
And
it's
that's why it's so exciting after 5 years, because like all the systems and the actual business operations are hopefully solid, and then from there you can kind of like take it to
that's
the next
actually
level.
Really true, because I feel like the first 5 years for me were so much of like really basic stuff, like learning how to run the business, how to hire people, how to work with people, on the design side, the sales side, the marketing side, just really, really, really basic things that when you get another job for an existing company usually are like spoon-fed to you. We had to like create those systems from scratch. Like, how do we think of marketing and like how do we organize our calendar? Like, what's the company culture? I had no idea about so many of those things. And now I feel like we're finding a place where like there's a system. So now you could probably just like focus on making the message even greater versus like operationally trying to figure something out.
So this is sort of like jumping, since you're Steve, we're going to like skip way back real quick. Was there, I know you'd mentioned Sue that like the first time you kind of felt like you belonged anywhere was college. Is that right?
Post-college.
Post-college.
Or I guess in New York in general, post-college.
In New York in general.
It was very awkward during college. Yeah. New York was a, so going from San Diego, well, high school, I was not awkward in high school. I was fine in high school.
Believe me.
Super cool.
But like, I was fine. Cool I was like.
I played tennis.
Do you even know what that means?
I was just a little overachiever in high school and was on like class council, newspaper, varsity tennis. So I was fine. But no, college was, I mean, you know, I was like really naive coming from the suburbs of San Diego. I was not cool at all. And then New York is like a big, scary city. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think like, so one of the reasons we wanted to start the radio show was basically specifically for kids in Chinatown, mm-hmm. or just like Asian American kids, I guess, in New York. Mm-hmm. And not only the ones that are actually under the poverty line, but actually that kind of stigma of being other in mm-hmm. a place, even like New York, which is incredibly diverse, but certainly virtually anywhere else in the U.S. And I feel like there's always a kind of pivot point where you either are trying everything you can do to fit in, which oftentimes means like suppressing your Asian-ness.
For sure.
Or you're like, fuck it, I'm myself now, I'm going to be an individual of some sort, and you either go way out and actually be particularly eccentric, or you just kind of discover yourself in some way. And I do feel like in order to create something or start something on your own, that second path of like, I'm me now, has to sort of emerge somewhere. So I'm always curious, like, at which point does that start to happen for different people? And I do think it has a lot to do with where you grew up in, even the context of the environment you grew up in, and even the ethnicities that were around you when you grew up in. And I think it's amazing, actually, because I kind of feel the same way, where I didn't fully feel like at home until New mm-hmm. York. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to realize why that was, but it's probably a very similar reason. Where were you between high school and New York?
Between high school and New York? Oh, I went, like, what college? I went to Barnard uptown.
Uptown.
It's the all-women's college that's a part of Columbia University.
Was there a moment when you moved to the city where you're like, oh, shit, this is... Like, was there a tangible moment I was where like, you felt like, oh, damn, I'm actually a place where I can...
Yeah, well, I actually, for whatever reason, I don't know how I got New York in my head, but in high school, I just was obsessed with New York City. I didn't even been yet until the spring before senior year of high school. And then I interned, actually, when I was a rising senior, so the summer before senior year of high school, I interned in New York City at a PR firm called Workhouse Publicity that did actually a restaurant opening, the restaurant opening for Haru Sushi. Yeah, anyway, so that was like my, not my account, but the account I was assisting on. They did not let, I was just like doing guest list stuff. But that was, I don't know, it was just like so cool. And I just think during high school, I always was looking at what else was outside of San Diego. Mm-hmm. I mean, San Diego is a very sleepy beach town, and it was a beautiful place to have grown up, and I was very privileged having that kind of upbringing, like very safe. It was great, but I just wanted more. I wanted more culture. I think that's ultimately what it was, is like where I grew up just really lacked culture. Like there was none of that. And my parents, you know, they moved to the States from a country where, you know, they didn't speak English. And so I think that they've always had that adventure, that adventurous side to them. And I think that that was definitely instilled in me, and wanting to take that chance was something that, like, I was very comfortable in doing. And so after the internship, I definitely knew that I wanted to be in New York City. And it pretty much only applied to schools in New York.
Hannah, did you have the same sense? I forget where you said you grew up.
I grew up in Rockland County, which is 45 minutes north of Manhattan.
Oh.
I was just thinking about it because I pretty much grew up with the same people from kindergarten through almost high school. So I never really felt like there was a lot of racism, because you start off knowing everybody when they're 5 years old, and it's never like, oh, look, that's the Indian kid or that's the Asian kid. It was just more like, oh, there's Timmy. That's Joe. Like, oh, remember when Joe did this in elementary school? And I remember, so I always felt pretty comfortable with being Asian. It never felt weird to me, or I never felt out of place. And then I went to Georgetown, which was a big culture shock for me, because the area I grew up in, while it was very white, was not preppy at all. In Georgetown, I was like, what is this?
Who are you people?
What is happening?
But what about like dating? Like, I remember growing up, like, I did not feel, like, one of the big reasons why I didn't feel like I fit in is because I didn't think that the boys liked me because I was Asian.
Really? Well, I don't know. There weren't that many cute boys in my high school. Also, because you've known them since kindergarten, you just, it wasn't
family.
That exciting. Yeah.
They're like siblings.
Yeah, they're more like siblings in a way. But when I got to Georgetown, what I thought was interesting was, so my friends from public school were a mix, predominantly white, because the school is predominantly white. And then I grew up in a Chinese American church, so almost all of my friends from church were Chinese or Taiwanese or Asian. And then when I got to Georgetown, I joined the Chinese American Student Society, made a bunch of friends there. And they always used to say that, like, oh, you only hang out with white kids. I'm like, what am I doing here then with you guys? You know, I was just never Asian enough for them. And then for my white friends, maybe I wasn't white enough for them. So it was always, it felt weird to me to be caught in this limbo, because my whole life I was, it was just always, this is who I, right. It's not a conversation. This is who I am regardless of race or not. So I found that really funny in a way, because I'm like, oh, well, if you saw all my friends from home, they're all Chinese. And I just didn't pick my friends based on race. But
at Georgetown, were you, I imagine those two groups were not hanging out together?
No.
You were like, were you bouncing basically back and forth between the two?
Yes.
Would you notice that you would behave differently depending on which group you were in?
No, not really. I would say the two groups had different interests. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, we're going to go to Faux 75 in Virginia for Faux, you know, and...
This is the white kid group, right?
No. Yeah. So, and it was nice to have that piece of home. And it's funny, one of my friends who's Taiwanese American, she used this term, which she's like, I don't care what ethnicity I marry, but they just have to be Asian literate. And I was like, what does Asian literate mean? She's like, so basically, you know, if some delicious dish comes over and I want to dump all the sauce and eat it with a bowl of rice, they'd be like, yeah, I get that. Mm-hmm. Or like, my trainer's Australian Chinese, and we obsess over finding the best fish balls, and we send each other recipes. Whereas, like, probably the average American would be like, what do you mean fish balls? That sounds disgusting. Yeah. Or like, or, you know, so I was like, Asian literate. Wow, that's such a great term.
Have you always, I mean, obviously with Mimi Chang's, you're now very connected to not only your Asian-ness, mm-hmm. but also your mom's cooking and kind of like the upbringing, I guess, you had. Were you always that connected, or was there actually a period where you sort of like felt too disconnected from it and wanted to come back to it?
I think we always felt pretty connected to it, but, you know, Chinese food is really hard to make unless you have all the ingredients, and it's such a pain in the butt to make. Mm-hmm. Like, just yesterday morning, I was Googling a place to find Taiwanese breakfast, and
I was like, is there a place?
What is Taiwanese breakfast?
Oh, my God.
We'll show you our ways.
I would say you could find some of it in Hong Kong, or, like, parts of it, yeah.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
soy milk, warm soy milk.
Yeah.
What about that? There's, like, a bread thing that's, like, fried wrapped in a noodle.
Yeah. Right? Saobing with yutiao. Yeah.
The long one?
Yeah.
Oh, not a long one.
Yutiao is a long one, which is basically a piece of fried dough. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Yeah.
Or cruller, or whatever.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was like a Taiwanese thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or
meatballs.
Or scallion pancakes with eggs. Or yeah.
Okay. Oh, so I definitely grew up eating this stuff, having no idea that it was Taiwanese. Yeah.
That was from Hong Kong.
I thought it was always Taiwanese.
But in Hong Kong, a lot of people eat like Taiwanese.
There's
like
also bubble tea is Taiwanese. By the way.
Yeah. Pork buns are also Taiwanese. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like my whole conception of Cantonese food is completely out the window.
Shattered.
You've all been eating Taiwanese food this whole time.
Pretty much.
Pretty much, actually.
Yeah.
And you spent most of your time, you spent most of your time growing up in Hong Kong, or like back and forth between
Hong Kong. So I think something interesting for me is that, you know, my parents are together, but my dad primarily worked overseas, I would say like 70% of the year, like my whole childhood. So I was really raised by my mom, who, I didn't say this earlier, but she actually, like, I see her also as being a pretty kind of adventurous, entrepreneurial person, but more as, like, a homemaker. And she really did a lot to, like, really, like, kind of get my brother and I, like, all over Hong Kong, like, really immersed in the culture. And my dad's family, most of them don't speak English, so we'd spend, like, all of our Saturdays and stuff with them. And because my mom doesn't speak Chinese, like, one of the things that she decided to do was, in school, you got tested and graded on Mandarin. So even though Hong Kong is Cantonese speaking, we spoke Mandarin with all of our family, and like, we were like beaten to death to learn Mandarin.
Every Chinese child is beaten to death, right?
For sure.
Beaten to death.
Yeah. But the interesting thing was, in Hong Kong, my Mandarin is better than my Cantonese, just because I'm more comfortable speaking and reading it, for example. But I grew up around my Chinese family that constantly reminded me, or like would be like, oh, are you Chinese or are you American? Or like, we'd have dinner on Saturday nights and they're like, do you like Chinese food better or do you like American food better? And
how do you feel when they ask you that question?
I mean, it's interesting, because I was talking to Sue about this earlier before we started the talking, but like, a big thing for me and a big thing behind the brand is that I really want to identify with people who have, you know, not, I'm not so interested in like polarity, like you're one thing or you're the other, but you're kind of in between. Mm-hmm. Because I really identify with being Chinese and being white. Mm-hmm. And like in some places, those things like really go together. And then in some places, and I feel like, you know, you guys must have something similar too, that it's, they can be conflicting, but somehow they exist mm-hmm. together. Did you,
I think sometimes when I look at my breakfast, I think of how they coexist, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm eating salbing with scrambled egg with soy sauce and white pepper and then a sliced avocado on top.
There you go.
Like, yeah. This is great.
So I think that that's like a really big, like basically when I was growing up until like 15, I was in Hong Kong and I just like, I think I was constantly reminded that I was white. Mm. And then also because I was with my mom and she was really like spending all of our time or all of our time was with her. I just, you know, my mom and I look the same except that my mom is blonde with green eyes. And, you know, I have, you know, dark brown hair and brown eyes. But I kind of, like, didn't actually realize that I was Chinese or Chinese looking until I came to the States to go to boarding school and then college. But the actual, like, really crazy thing was that I was in a relationship in my 20s for, like, most of my 20s with one person. So I wasn't really, like, out there dating people. But in, like, the later half of my 20s, I started, like, dating other people and, like, kind of getting out there again. And I started to realize that, like, for the most part, guys that would hit me up were all into Asian girls.
Oh, nobody likes the Asian fetish.
Yellow fever?
No.
But the thing that was so crazy was that it was literally, like, in my late 20s that I realized, like, very clearly
you're
that
like
other people think I'm Asian or I'm Chinese. Because, you know, my mom's family came to the States on the Mayflower. They're very white. And she just would always tell us these stories about being, like, one of the first, like, families in America. And, like, you know, just very white stories. So, and then that coupled with, like, every time you go to the grocery store and you say something in Chinese, they're like, why do you speak Chinese?
Right.
You know, you just kind of think after a while, like, okay, I'm totally, like, people think I'm white. Mm. And then I came to the States and, you know, it became clear that, like, a lot of people actually think you're, like, Chinese or just some kind of Asian, you know, and it's not clear.
Between here and Hong Kong, is one more open or accepting of being both?
I mean, I think the community that I was a part of, like, particularly within school or, like, my parents...
Is in Hong Kong or here?
In Hong Kong. And also my parents were, like, very involved in their church in Hong Kong. Just those cultures, I think, are so much more, like, mixed couples. Mm. And actually something else that was really funny was my 25th or 26th birthday. And also, I think when it's not really tested too much, you don't think about it. So I'm like, yeah, I'm a really open person because, you know, I'm exposed to so many different cultures and stuff like that. And my, like, 25th or 26th birthday, I actually had it at Momofuku Sambar. And one of my friends organized it for me. And she was like, just give me a list of, like, 10 people you want to have at the dinner or whatever. And when we got to dinner, I realized that every single, it was like five couples or something, and every single couple was like some kind of like Asian and white.
Are you serious?
And I was like, whoa, I'm actually just super homogenous and like really close-minded. And I just like what I am, apparently. But I didn't, I mean, there's like so many things. I think there's like a sense of self-awareness that when you ask about like belonging or like where do you start to realize like you really felt comfortable, I think that maybe the exercise of starting the brand for me has been to like find myself too.
I was literally just thinking that as you were saying, because I'd never thought of that before in terms of, well, there's a pattern I noticed talking with a lot of guests, especially because it's a creative roster of people.
Yeah.
That the arts and the creative field in general seem much more open to minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about that, and part of that I think is because inherently in the creative field, you're always looking for something new, or you're actually looking for something different.
Or
and so,
something that might fit you very specifically in a way that doesn't exist
it has
already.
It's got to be unique. Exactly. It's got to be unique in some way. And so relying on the sort of middle road or whatever is tried and true, and this applies, I think, also to the ethnicity of people that are practicing it, is just not interesting. So it applies to, I think, gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, like everything.
Literally, I think what you're talking about is what I feel like my brand and like the point of this, like what I'm trying to intersect with is this conversation is that like I think a lot of people don't necessarily aren't necessarily born into their identity, the identity that they're exposed to,
right.
You know, or that they like, you know, whether it's your body or like the way you physically look or like the community, mm-hmm. like, you know, like coming from maybe like a very small suburban town, but your mind actually needs to be somewhere else. I think that's something I'm like very interested in.
Well, I can imagine like whether it's fashion, food, or food. that, and I only say this because I only think about it now, like through architecture or design was the first time, or you felt, I felt a community in architecture that had nothing to do with what people look like mm-hmm. or where they came from. And so that was my identity for a long time was architecture. And so then the company started and stuff. And weirdly, then through that type of identity, am I now actually reflecting back on the like physical identity of myself?
Come back to yourself.
Yeah, it's like weirdly, I feel more Chinese-y and Asian than I probably ever have.
I feel like that's, I don't know.
This late in life? Like, it's taken a fucking long time to kind of come.
Oh, my God, yeah, totally. Did you see the T Magazine article that came out yesterday about why there aren't more Asian Americans represented in like film, television, kind of like in front of the screen versus behind the screen?
No,
Thessaly LaForce, who's a dear friend,
really good,
really, really good. Who's half Taiwanese, half Caucasian. It's a really incredible read. I recommend everyone.
It
just came out yesterday.
Maybe we'll do a reading of it tomorrow or something.
Yeah, you should. There's lots of great lines in it, but it's essentially about how, for all sorts of reasons, or just really putting into question, like, why is it that Asian Americans aren't accepted as pop stars, as the lead actor? And, you know, very much so we play the caricatures of the sidekick or...
Oh, these, like, kind of bigger, greater, like, American conversations of, like, what a Chinese stereotype is. And
exactly. But then at the same...
That's what the art... I mean...
Yeah, but, you know, of course there are a lot of celebrated Asian Americans, but a lot of them tend to be behind the scenes. So, like, writers or fashion designers making dresses that, like, the celebrities wear as opposed to... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. In the kitchen. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a really interesting exploration of, like, why is it that Americans haven't accepted us as the lead actor or...
So it's only come up a couple times in the last week, which I'm surprised, but I feel like we have to bring it up, but... Did you guys see Crazy Rich Asians?
Of course. Opening weekend.
Bought 6 tickets.
I did. I'm waiting to see it on the plane. I'm not a big like movie goer. I mean, I obviously definitely want to.
I'm not a big movie goer either, but you got to support
I know.
Well, I read the book because I was very fascinated by just the whole concept and the fact that it was like a New York Times bestseller. And I mean, I blew through it. It's like super easy.
It's a beach read.
Yeah, it's super easy. It's great, though. I mean... that was also during the phase of when I was really exploring my Asianness and, like, for the first time dating Asian guys, honestly, truthfully, which I'm embarrassed to say that it took this long, but...
We're on the up, I think.
Yeah.
You guys are in hot demand now.
Hot demand. It was really incredible to see that movie, and Joylet Club played a large role in my upbringing, for sure, and that book as well, and, yeah, I think it's important to see... people who look like you be things that you
aren't
didn't
stereotypical.
Yeah, exactly. That you didn't think that you could be. It is very important.
Yeah,
to see
like
that,
the abs on the guys.
I was even like, this is a moment.
We're like, hey.
Yeah. Like
all women everywhere were like, Asian guys have those.
Seriously.
Abs?
That was like so. I feel like I've said this a bunch of times, but the moment where I was like, shit, this is actually something special is
the abs.
The abs, yeah. But it was actually because like. There were two girls sitting next to me that I didn't know, and I don't think they're even Asian. And the first time, like, 12-foot abs flashed on screen, there was an audible, like, mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, shit, I have never heard any, like, Asian or non-Asian woman actually, like, say anything like that to Asian abs. Yeah.
But the sad thing about that is, like, all of those actors were non-American. Mm. Like, right? Only a few of those actors were American. Definitely most of the men were non-American. They were all foreign. Either British or actually from Asia, because they couldn't find any Asian actors. And Aziz Ansari talks a lot about this too. When he was making Master of None, he was trying to find a little kid to play him as a youngster, and he couldn't find a little Indian kid to act as him because they just didn't exist. Like,
well, yeah, if you don't see you on the screen, you'd probably be discouraged from applying.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you'll never be a leading man because we'll point out a leading man that's Indian that looks like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's. I mean, I feel like that's also such an important shift. Like. What's crazy is I didn't identify really with any, I'm guessing most people didn't identify with any of the characters in Crazy Rich Asians. It's like I had that same Crazy Rich experience. But it was literally just because they looked moderately like me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was like they were Asian of sorts.
Yeah.
Was enough to be like, and it's like you said, it's like you've never just seen someone like that that's a leading actor, actress, whatever, on a screen like that at that level in America.
Without being portrayed as a stereotypical right. character of right. like, mm-hmm. Love Me Long Time or, you know, the restaurant or the dry cleaning guy. Like, how many of you guys
like
have been
It's like either you're docile or like a dragon lady. You right, know, it's exactly. like one or it's like the extremes.
Or
there's nothing.
You're
not just
tiger
not,
hidden.
You're
dragon.
Just not normal. Right. You can't be normal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You're like, I'm just me. Yeah.
And so, like, I guess as a way to, because I really it's already, as a way to sort of like last question, do you guys feel responsibility or excitement with potentially being a model to other people that are, oh shit,
always.
There's a person that I kind of look like doing something kind of incredible?
I think that's the exciting part of it. And I don't know. I think it just going back to Crazy Rich Asians is to see somebody who remotely looks like you or remotely has the same background do something. It just opens the horizons of like, oh, okay, it broadens your mind that could be a possibility mm-hmm. for you. Doesn't mean you have to do it, but like,
yeah,
it's cool.
I think the other thing that it does do is like, the community around what you do really makes a big difference. And for your parents, for example, to know that like there are other, like for me, wanting to go into fashion was really hard for my dad to accept. I mean, my mom has always been super supportive, but my dad was like, you know, the very typical, there are only these types of jobs. Mm. And
it's the one job he didn't do.
Yeah.
He's like, did you see me try it?
You know, no. I think his perspective was like, I worked really hard so you didn't have to go down mm-hmm. this kind of route. You know, for him, he had no idea that, like, you can actually make a living doing fashion or, like, you know, you can go, if you wanted to, you could go the corporate route. You could, you know, have a great lifestyle, make a lot of money, like, benefits. There's a lot of things there that those are real jobs that, like, real people have. And if you work hard at them, you can mm-hmm. get those jobs. But, like, if your parents don't know that, they won't be open to letting you try it. So I think on the one hand, it's the actual person who has the interest, but then it's like the community being familiar makes it easier for them to right. be like supportive of, you know, the idea.
Definitely. Even I remember before I got to college, I thought, oh, if I go into finance, that means I'm going to be an accountant.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, that sounds safe. And then my life, it was by chance or by fate. So my friend had gone through this minority internship program. And she got an internship at GE and then recommended that I go through it too. So I did, and I was originally an accounting intern. And then the trading floor decided they wanted an intern that summer. So the HR, the guy in charge of the program said, okay, they're going to pick 6 resumes, re-interview those 6 people for this position. And I told him, I was like, oh, you know, like, I don't think it fits my personality. I've read about it. And he was like, well, you didn't get it anyways yet, so why don't you just interview? I was like, okay, good point. So interview, and I got it, and they were like, well, she doesn't want it. We don't want her. And he said, trust me, you guys both want each other. Just try it out. And then that's how I joined the trading floor. But otherwise, it would have been an accountant, a CPA.
Damn. That could have been so different.
Who was this recruiter guy or the guy who was like, you need to do, or like,
Justin Howe. Shout out to Justin Howe, who was at GE, who's Asian American.
Thanks, Asian Americans.
Yeah, looking out. Yeah.
Actually, one of the most inspiring Asian American moments that I've had just maybe in my life was Carol and Umberto of Opening Ceremony invited me as their guest to the Apex Gala that was at Cipriani.
You and my sister are obsessed
oh
with
my
Apex.
God.
Dude, I love Apex.
Well, because I've like
was
never
this the
been.
Last one?
I was.
I didn't meet you.
Yeah, it was the last. I was in a room. There were like 800 Asian people there.
It was
there.
So incredible.
And there were
Can
so
I
many
come next year?
Incredible yeah. Asian people there. And it was like, whoa.
I'm such a shill for Apex.
There's so many. Like, it was really inspiring to see. I mean, it's shocking once again that I'm like this old and it's like now I'm discovering all of this. But it was really incredible to be in a room full of a lot of Asian Americans who were doing amazing, creative, innovative things. I mean, a lot of them in fashion, actually. Mm-hmm. But
was that the year that Connie Chung was a presenter?
It was this year. Oh, no, okay. It wasn't Connie Chung. I forgot who it was. But yeah, it was just like really inspiring to be in a room full of really successful Asian Americans, mm-hmm. you know, who were all in the creative arts. And so yeah, for sure, it's important to see that and to be around that.
It's really amazing. That was actually do you guys know Karen Wong from the New Museum?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she.
Oh my god, she had like a power Asian table at that event.
Yeah. Yeah, so like she.
So what do we have to do to get invited to this?
The show is like a direct invitation, right?
Yeah, you guys are all right. We're confirmed. We'll have a radio table.
Okay, I've got my address often, so.
So Preeti, who was actually our very first guest on the radio show, is the, I forgot his title, like board president or something like that, and also an architect. So basically anybody that's new that is excited about it, he'll find a way to get them in without like a stupid like table fee. I'm probably like blowing up Apex right now. But
yeah. like we need that fundraising.
Yeah, right? No, seriously. Anyway, but no, that was a huge actually like door opening back to like mm-hmm. Asian Americanness that
I actually signed up to volunteer as a
mentor?
As a mentor, yeah. I did the
whole
interview.
You know who's her character witness? Me.
Yeah. Did they call you?
No, they sent me a form to
fill out. Oh.
I gave you rave reviews.
Do your character witnesses have to be Asian?
No, I don't even know why I picked you.
Because you're trustworthy.
Highly reliable.
Yeah. Responsive on email.
Responsible, just in general, yeah.
I actually made Bug Preeti to do like an Apex special of like food radio or something, because I feel like half the people either know about it and were there mm-hmm. actually, and the Angela DiMayuga yeah. brought the same thing where she was actually watching the live feed of Carolyn Umberto's thing, and she's like, I want to go next year. But that'd be rad. I'm sure we can get you. I don't know why I say we. I'm not even I just given them some money. I don't really like to much
we can
else.
Like wait the tables there, right?
yeah.
But anyway, thank you guys for
thank
coming
so
by tonight
much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
This is rad.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This is a good thing that you're doing.
Thank you. good luck with everything.
Thanks, you too. And thanks for the peanuts. We demolished this bowl of
they're
peanuts.
So good.
By the way, for the record, the weird liquor,
that liquor is
like burned through
yeah.
the table.
That's kind of gnarly.
Burned through the cups and it's now all over the table. But
we also have to say Nancy did a great job.
Nancy was incredible.
Good job, Nancy.
Yeah. Listening to your personal story was so inspiring. Yeah.
Actually, Nancy and I are part of an Asian eating club, which you all, which Sarah has, Sarah Law has participated in. But
same.
Everyone
me
is,
too. Yeah. I always thought I was a part of it until Sue says that. I'm like, I thought I was a part of this.
It's with our other Asian friends.
That's what we call hate on hate. Asian on Asian hate.
Wait, right. How do you join this Asian? let's bring this. Let's start the radio back up. Let's talk about this Asian eating club.
I know. Well,
Sunday
you may
nights,
all join. It's funny at first.
You get an email, then you know.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
A tap on the shoulder.
It happens like once every quarter. I mean, everyone who's in it is very busy.
Once
and
a quarter. I haven't been in 2 years. Did I say something?
I know. But we rotate people in and out, and new people join. Hop on.
We'll add you to all the short list.
Yeah.
If you can't make it, then you don't get to come ever again. No kidding. But yeah, it's fun. We used to go to non-Asian restaurants, and they were like, we should really be going to Asian restaurants. Then we started going to Asian restaurants. But yeah.
All right. So Bug Sue, if you want to join the
Asian
club. Asian eating club. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You so much.